UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello all, welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Pradeep Mundre, and I'm your host for today. Now, today's episode is about approach to individuals with family history of colorectal cancer. And colorectal cancer is probably one of the common issues that I come across on a day-to-day, whether it's in the context of screening or prevention or surveillance. And in my daily practice, I often come across patients, whether in the outpatients when they present symptoms or when I'm doing procedures, when they do mention about family history of colorectal cancer. And often I'm not really sure how to approach such patients. I mean, in terms of their risk or how to approach in terms of surveillance, whether we should offer them or not. I mean, I'm talking about those patients who do not have hereditary syndrome, such as Lynch syndrome or familial adenomatous polyposis. I often find it easy in such patients because they're clear guidelines. But for those who don't, I seem to struggle in my approach. And I often find it very confusing to remember the advice and the guidelines. And amongst clinicians, we're probably guilty in a very inconsistent approach in dealing with such patients. I feel that there's a lot of missed opportunities in recognizing such individuals. And sometimes probably there's an over-exaggeration of the risk leading on to unnecessary procedures. Now, the focus of the discussion today is primarily on such individuals, as in how to approach such patients with family history of colorectal cancer who do not already have an established diagnosis of inherited syndromes, such as familial adenomatous polyposis or Lynch syndrome. Now, today's guest is Dr. Kevin Monahan, consultant gastroenterologist at St. Mark's Hospital, London, and one of the leading figures in hereditary colorectal cancers. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today. We are so pleased to have you as a guest.
Thank you very much, Pradeep. Good to be here.
So, Kevin, to start off with, can you tell us a little bit about your journey from being a young doctor to being such an influential person in hereditary colorectal cancers?
Well, thank you very much. I guess although this is a common problem, it's still an area where as a profession, it's probably still quite a niche. And it's a niche I had developed an interest in during medical training when I studied a family from where I'm from in Ireland, where there was a history of polyps and cancer running through the family, to try and understand why it was happening. And I found it very interesting, you know, because normally, I suppose, in our practice, we deal with individuals. And although we take account of family history, I found the idea of getting to know different individuals in a family and managing their care over their lifetime just really incredibly interesting. And the dynamics in families are so hugely variable, and what you consider normal is largely based on your own experience of, you know, growing up. And actually, you know, there are families where there are people I know who are siblings and they don't know about each other. They don't know each other exists even. And there are other families which are, you know, very, very close and it's just very interesting working with people. And because it is a niche, there aren't so many people maybe who are very focused in this area. And therefore, there are many opportunities to optimize care and to think about what could be done to achieve that. So it's been very stimulating for me through my career to work in this area, because I feel like there are lots of solutions that are just sitting there waiting to be kind of delivered on. And, you know, also appreciating that this is a relatively common problem, that lots of people have a family history of cancer, and bowel cancer is a common disease, and therefore having a family history of bowel cancer is common. It's not always due to something running in the family, but trying to make sense of that, I think, is, you know, there are some simple kind of tips and tricks that can be applied to make sense of that.
Oh, we expect you to make things very simple for us, Kevin, today. Niche indeed, definitely. And, you know, for a gastroenterologist to have this particular specialty is very rare. And when I found your main interest in this. I was fascinated, and I thought you're the best person to invite you for this discussion. So, Kevin, let's start with the prevalence of this problem, as in family history of colorectal cancer. How common do you think it is, in a sort of broader sense?
Well, if colorectal cancer, bowel cancer, affects about 4 to 5% of women and about 6% of men, it's a common disease that affects 1 in 20 individuals. And in theory, if you take 20 people from any family, there'd probably be one person who has colorectal cancer over their lifetime, if it was entirely random. But and what we do know, though, if you actually look at families and you look how many families have a first degree relative with colorectal cancer or a second degree relative with colorectal cancer, it's about 9 to 10% have a first degree relative, which means a parent or a sibling or a child, and about another 20% have a second degree relative. So that's about just almost 30% of families where there's a first or a second degree relative with colorectal cancer. And although that makes it relatively common, if you take the UK population of whatever, 65 million, whatever it is, that's more than 20 million people with a family history of colorectal cancer. And, it's a lot of people, therefore, it's a common condition or common situation, rather. But what does that actually mean practically? Well, a lot of that family history is not due to a genetic trait running through the family or necessarily an increased genetic risk. But, it can be incorporated into our risk modeling. Also, many of those people with a family history, those diagnoses are due to random events that occur in families. There may be random genetic events that account for quite a lot of cancer, as well as environmental risk. And sometimes when you have more than one case in a family, it might be because of shared environment. It may not be due to genetic traits, but in reality, it is a little complicated. There's a lot of overlap. And people don't get cancer for just because of environmental reasons or just because of genetic reasons, really, except in very, very extreme situations. Most cancers occur because of a mixture of all these reasons. And therefore, when you take family history, it forms part of your risk assessment. And, the other way of looking at it is, actually, what's the benefit of scoping people with family history or offering other interventions? I mean, predominantly, it's about choosing when or how to colonoscope or whether or not to colonoscope. It's not the only thing, but it's the main kind of decision point that we make as gastroenterologists probably. And there are ways of trying to kind of stratify that risk for what is a common situation.
Right. So when you talk about stratification, can you give us your thoughts on what is your threshold to define an increased risk, of colorectal cancer in those patients? How do you... What do you consider as an increased risk compared to general population? So what is more sort of significant, in terms of surveillance?
Yeah, sure. I would say that there's pretty much no one who has 0% risk, and risk is a gradient. And therefore, some people are all along a spectrum of risk for all these common diseases, including diabetes and heart disease and colorectal cancer being another common disease. But the way to simplify it down is the risk significantly higher than someone who has an average lifetime risk in the population, and by how much? And so in BSG and ESG guidelines, essentially we've identified a population of people who have a risk which is around about doubled. So the lifetime risk is about 10% or more, and compared to 5% of the population. And when that risk is 10% or more, the other thing we're interested in is what's the mitigation of colonoscopic surveillance. And you can look then at the studies that where colonoscopy has been offered to people with family history, and you can see how many advanced adenomas or how many colorectal cancers are identified when you offer surveillance. And if you're not actually finding anything more, although the lifetime risk of colorectal cancer is higher, then actually maybe colonoscopy isn't really necessarily the right answer, or maybe that it's not been offered at the right age. So you kind of want to know, what age do people get more advanced adenomas or colorectal cancers where there's family history? So you can risk stratify on the basis of the type of family history. We know that if someone has one first degree relative diagnosed before the age of 50, or if they have two first degree relatives diagnosed at any age in a cluster in the family, so that, we can kind of outline that in more detail in a moment. then that lifetime risk for that individual is around about doubled. And we know that if you offer colonoscopy to people with that family history, we find more or less twice as many advanced adenomas, typically from around the age of 50 onwards. And if you offer colonoscopy before 50, you don't tend to find anything more. So the risk of cancer really in people with this kind of family history starts to increase from around about 50. That's when they start to benefit from colonoscopy. In fact, the risk of cancer is probably a little bit later. It's more the advanced adenomas that are more likely to occur around the age of 50, increase in prevalence onwards. So, and then when you get, you know, a stronger family history, you might start colonoscopy a bit earlier because you may get, you know, more advanced adenomas earlier and the lifetime risk of cancer is greater. And that might be families where there are three people in the family who've had colorectal cancer, for example.
I was going to come on to that question as in, you know, people, when you, individuals, you meet them in your clinic or your endoscopy list and they mention about family history, then my question was, you know, what information should trigger further questioning or detailed family history? The way you're saying is that, yeah, if they mention, you go in detail straight away and then ask more questions, judge them based on what you've mentioned already.
Yeah, I mean, I would say if someone says that their parent had colorectal cancer when they're in their 60s, then probably that doesn't really significantly increase that individual's risk of colorectal cancer to the point where by you would offer additional, you know, there's usually in most countries there are national screening programs and that's probably appropriate for them. Now, it does depend partially on what system, health system people work in, and some health systems, you know, there's a lower threshold for offering additional, you know, colonoscopy. For example, in the US, people are offered additional colonoscopy and they have screening from an earlier age. And that is, you know, down to a number of factors. Resources would be one of those factors, but not the only one. And we all suppose, rationalize what we do in our own health systems to an extent. But I think one of the key things that we try to focus on within our guidelines is it's not really resources. It's about what is actually going to benefit that patient. What do we know about the benefit of colonoscopy? And if the risk is slightly increased, do we actually know that the colonoscopy, you know, perform differently compared to what how it's offered in the screening program for, you know, for the entire population? What do we know that offering additional colonoscopy is going to be helpful? And we know that probably it is where they report that their parent had colorectal cancer, you know, in their 40s, or that they had a parent who was in their 60s and the parent's, you know, parents or the parent's brother or sister, for example. So there are two people in the family. And we know that those families, that what we do with colonoscopy is more likely to benefit them.
Okay. Kevin, at this stage, when you've started talking about family history, I guess the main question is how to filter out patients who we feel they should be referred for genetic testing. You know, I mean, I guess definition of Lynch syndrome or Lynch syndrome type patients. So what is it in the family history that you should say, okay, fine, these are the patients I would refer for genetic testing? So what are the criteria that you would use in clinical practice?
Well, one of the things that we do in the UK and in some countries, not everywhere, is once someone is referred with a family history of colorectal cancer, we try and see if that relative has had a test of some sort for Lynch syndrome. Because actually, that is an additional layer of risk assessment that is really valuable. Because we think that most cancer that runs in families, the most common cause is Lynch syndrome. And by testing the tumor with immunohistochemistry or microsatellite instability testing, we can essentially rule out a diagnosis of Lynch syndrome where the testing is normal. And we can reassure individuals that they probably don't have a very high risk trait running through the family. So that's kind of an important layer that we can offer. And conversely, if that test is abnormal, then that individual perhaps, you know, that family may benefit from additional genetic testing because they might have Lynch syndrome if the test is abnormal, of course. Most of the time it won't be, but if it is, then they need further kind of genetic assessment. Now, that is only going to be the case in exceptions and people with a kind of moderate family history that I've mentioned, those with a one relative under 50 or those with two relatives. Where you get people where there are three affected individuals in the family, the likelihood of this tumor test being abnormal is really much higher. And that's because more of those families are likely to occur because of Lynch syndrome, which hasn't been previously diagnosed in the family. So I would probably suggest that where there are three people in the family, they may benefit from a genetic assessment. And, you know, the genetic assessment that's occurring is evolving very, very quickly. So, you know, currently in many countries, people who have been diagnosed with bowel cancer before 50 are offered gene panel testing to see if there's a genetic diagnosis for that early age onset colorectal cancer. It's under 40 in the UK, actually, but, you know, it's under 50 in Spain, for example. And in the US, it's under 50. And so increasingly, people are being offered who have had a diagnosis of cancer genetic testing. So much of the useful information is probably in the relative who's been diagnosed with cancer. And, you know, obtaining information about that relative might be helpful. But, you know, if we don't have that information or it's difficult to obtain, usually the person who's referred because they've gone to the GP and said, I've got a family history, I want to, you know, have a colonoscopy, usually, you know, they're pretty proactive and they can just ask their relative, have you had a genetic test? Do you have any information about having had a test? Have you been offered one? And they might have. But, you know, failing that, you can only go on the best available information. You want to have the best information in order to be able to make the best decisions for your patients. But if the best information is there are three people in the family, you know, my father died when he was 40, 30 years ago, and, you know, I'm now 45, I've not had a colonoscopy, plus there are a couple of others in the family, then actually you might consider offering that person a genetic test on the basis that there are three people in the family. So there are various different ways, but I would say, first of all, if there's been some form of tumor testing in an affected individual, then they may be eligible. Secondly, their relative may have been offered testing. And thirdly, if there are three people in the family. And then the other thing to consider, I suppose, is, you know, we're talking about family history of cancer, but if someone has multiple adenomas, for example, if there are 10 or more adenomas, then they would also probably be eligible in many cases. Certainly they should be, you know, further assessed and be offered a discussion about genetic testing.
Right. And how the tumor testing is new, especially in the MDTs when it comes the last few years, certainly in the UK. How common is tumor testing done or access to these things in other countries in Europe? Is it very common or is it a very UK thing to do?
Well, so in 2017, the NICE, the NHS body, recommended that all new colorectal cancer diagnoses undergo tumor testing. And in 2020, the same for endometrial cancer. Actually, although it was slightly ahead of the curve, I would, you know, say that most European countries are doing this. And this is partially because of an interest in Lynch syndrome, but also because it also refines oncological management. So the test for this mismatch repair test is an essential part of oncological decision making because of a new, relatively new form of treatment with something called checkpoint inhibitor immunotherapy. And that really has, you know, huge implications for people, especially with metastatic colorectal cancer. And as part of that, the MMR tumor status is a key kind of decision making point. And in fact, there's more and more of this kind of testing for a whole range of molecular markers and tumors that mean that people can be offered personalized care. And this is not really much to do with Lynch syndrome, but actually it's the same test. And, you know, people can A, have oncological decision-making personalized on the basis of that test, but also may potentially have a diagnosis of Lynch syndrome, which needs to be followed up on the basis of the result of that test as well. So it's becoming more and more mainstream, and that the driver for that has been really from oncology in recent years, I would say. And therefore, it is much more widespread. And although the guideline in the UK was released in 2017 recommending this, really the driver has come over the last 2 or 3 years from oncology. And so there's much more of this kind of testing taking place around the UK, but also internationally.
Kevin, I refer to the guidelines that you wrote for British Society, and on a practical note, you've classified those individuals into different categories. You've classified them as average risk, moderate risk, and high risk individuals. And, you know, listeners can refer to the guidelines and look at which individual fulfills or fits into each category. What maybe it's important to kind of make it clear is about this issue about first degree, second degree relative. You know, when you say two individuals with family history, two first degree relatives, what does that mean? Let's start by giving an example. Let's say if an individual has father diagnosed with colorectal cancer and father's brother. So that's one first degree relative. The second one is second degree, but was related to the father. So would that still be classed as moderate risk individual?
That's a very good question. It's something that people often don't quite get right, because, and that includes people who work in genetic departments. So it's not something, you know, that is really as straightforward as it should be, really, I think. But the answer to your question is that they would be a cluster of two first-degree relatives in the family. And anyone who's a first-degree relative of one of the affected members should therefore be offered surveillance accordingly. So they don't both need to be a first-degree relative of your patient. So if their father and their uncle, they're in a what's called first-degree kinship, then the children of that uncle and the children of the brothers and sisters of your patient as well as your patient, plus brothers and sisters of the uncle and the father and their parents, they're all eligible if they are under 75 years of age. And the parents are likely to be over 75, not always. People often do forget about the parents. And in fact, you know, for example, if you have someone diagnosed with colorectal cancer at 35, then it's often the siblings, the brothers and sisters who come forward and they're worried about their risk of colorectal cancer. But actually, the main people whose risk is increased are the mother and father of that individual, because you've got age added to the genetic risk, and people who are more likely to get advanced adenomas of cancers are still the older people in that family. So people sometimes forget about kind of looking up a generation as well. But so the affected individuals should be one genetic step away from each other, and anyone who's eligible is just one genetic step away from a single affected individual in that family. So if you have two people or three people, they just need to be related to each other in a sort of a cluster. And anyone who's one step off of that cluster is of relatives is eligible, because they're likely to benefit from additional surveillance as defined that way.
Okay. So when you talk about, you know, high risk, three individuals affected, as long as each one is a first degree relative of each other, and the affected individual or individual in question is first degree relative of the affected individual members, and that is, you know, that is the relevant. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. It's somewhat difficult to describe, I guess, in a podcast as well.
Yes.
It's quite nice to have a visual representation. You have to kind of think in your head of drawing a family tree and thinking how does that all kind of fit together. So it's the same, for example, if your mother and your mother's father, you know, you're a kind of a close relative of one affected individual, your mother, and you're a second degree relative of your grandparents, but still there are two people in the family who are related to each other who both had cancer and first degree kinship, and same situation. So you don't need to, it doesn't need to be, for example, your dad and your brother, you know, you don't need to be first degree relative of both those individuals, as long as they are related to each other.
Okay. That was the main question I had, is does everyone needs to be first degree relative of each other, of individual in question? I definitely would recommend our listeners to go through the guidelines, especially the chapters or the topic on family history. I think you made it very clear in the guideline, sort of the categories and things, and I'm very pleased about it. Now, Kevin, once you've made a sort of, you've taken a full family history and you've kind of categorized them into different categories and you've kind of ruled out patients who need testing for Lynch syndrome and all that, then when it comes to offering intervention for such individuals, what is the intervention would you offer? Sort of, you know, are there any alternatives to them? What's the best way to, once you know their risk is higher, what is the best intervention that you would offer to such patients?
Well, the gold standard is colonoscopy. You know, obviously, you know, for reasons that we're all aware of, in terms of, you know, if you find a polyp, you can remove it at the time. And, you know, CT colonography, in my view, is an excellent test, diagnostic test to identify neoplasia in the colon. And, you know, there's an element of having expertise in interpretation, but essentially competent interpretation is as good as colonoscopy for lesions down to about 4 millimeters in size. Now, obviously, there are things you can't do, like you can't remove a polyp at the time. And the other thing to consider in this population is a lot of genetic conditions that lead to, you know, familial colorectal cancer are related to faulty DNA repair, including Lynch syndrome. And if you expose an individual with faulty DNA repair to radiation, you're potentially increasing their lifetime risk of developing cancer as a consequence of radiation exposure. Now, there is some objective evidence of this from animal models that have been exposed to radiation, animal models for things like Lynch syndrome, where they do develop more tumors as a consequence. There's no direct evidence of this in humans that have been exposed to radiation who have genetic syndromes. That would be extremely difficult as a study to try and do. But I think that what we don't want really is for someone to have 25 CT colonographies over the lifetime, for example. And so CT colonography may be, if somebody's having a single, screening episode where, they're having a one-off colonoscopy and then they're entering a fit screening program, then a CT colonography might well be a very useful and helpful test and wouldn't really have a significant impact on lifetime cancer risk due to radiation exposure. But if you're doing it over and over and over someone's lifetime, for example, if someone's due to have a 5-yearly screening procedure, and then actually you have to consider weigh that the benefits of having that screening procedure up against the risks of the radiation exposure. Other things like fit testing. So, once again, fit is a big fan of fit, but in the right context, it's a really good test to detect colorectal cancer. Our patients who should have, more invasive investigations because of a possible colorectal cancer diagnosis. It's not a great test to detect advanced adenomas. And our focus really in these individuals is cancer prevention. And where we know that their risk of developing cancer is increased, what we really want to be doing is removing the advanced adenomas to prevent that cancer. So FIT, isn't really quite there yet. And there have been a number of studies in people with family history with the use of FIT, but there's not really convincing data about its utility in this kind of population. I suppose they're the most studied kind of interventions. And there are other interventions like colon capsule. Well, there's zero data for colon capsule at the moment in this population. MRI, no data at all at the moment. But maybe, there will be some evolution and some combination. For example, you could, someone could have FIT alongside colonoscopy and you could space out the intervals by combining the two together in a different way, but that would need to be done in the context of a clinical trial, and that data doesn't exist yet. So, colonoscopy is the gold standard, and the quality of colonoscopy is extremely important as well. Sometimes the lesions and some of these, some of the genetic syndromes can be very subtle. People, typically with a family history, they won't have polyposis, they won't have dozens of polyps. Then, there may be, there are serrated polyposis syndrome families, and serrated polyps can be extremely subtle. In Lynch syndrome, the polyps and the lesions can be very subtle as well. So, it's I think colonoscopy performed to a high standard with good bowel preparation and complete examination of the colon is very important. CT colonography is acceptable, but probably best to avoid doing it repeatedly.
Quick note, Kevin, on the colonoscopy, and is there any role for, let's say, chromoendoscopy or virtual chromoendoscopy or dye-based chromoendoscopy in such individuals? Or should they be on particular advanced endoscopist list who performs these procedures? Is there any evidence for use of them or a simple, good quality white light endoscopy by an endoscopist with good key performance indicators are enough?
I would probably agree with the latter. I mean, there are two randomized controlled trials of the use of dye spray chromoendoscopy in the context of Lynch syndrome, for example, that didn't demonstrate superiority over white light examination. And it's worth noting that in those RCTs, the white light examinations and the dye spray colonoscopies were performed by high-performing colonoscopists, and therefore they already had a good baseline. So there may be some benefit of using dye spray where people's performance indicators are not, you know, as high as they would be in the hands of an expert, perhaps, because I suppose one of the benefits of dye spray is that it slows people down a little bit. They take a bit longer on extubation, particularly in the proximal colon. Then there are other things like LCI. There's even one observational series of the use of AI and Lynch syndrome, and it hasn't demonstrated superiority over white light, although it's in a small population. There's another study, which is completed recruitment, I believe, which is predominantly based in Spain, but also in Germany and Netherlands. And that is a timely study, and I think that will be probably releasing its results in the near future and may demonstrate some benefit of AI, for example. But really, what we really know is that a good quality white light examination is an excellent examination, and provided the bowel prep is good, and it, you know, that's the key thing, really.
Quick comment, Kevin. On do you advise any lifestyle changes for patients who come with family history? Any particular thing? What advice would you give? Just some mild, smaller lifestyle changes.
Well, even if there is a genetic trait which is undiagnosed in the family, for example, or even if there is a genetic trait, cancer is not driven by that genetic trait entirely, and it is modifiable through healthy lifestyle. So all the things that we normally advise our patients or our population to try and help manage or reduce their lifetime risk, such as, you know, having a healthy diet with, you know, plenty of fruit and veg and avoiding excess, you know, red meat, and maintaining normal BMI and exercising regularly as independent risk factors in the kind of average risk population. There's also direct evidence in people with family history or even in people with syndromes that these things are beneficial. So we should be emphasizing these, as, you know, some people think, well, what's the point if I have, this is running my family, I'm going to get cancer anyway. Well, you know, they may get cancer, but it may mean that they get cancer 10 years later, or it may not get cancer if they live a healthy lifestyle, for example. And, you know, those cancers that have occurred in the family might have been, you know, predominantly related to lifestyle factors and not genetic factors. You know, in practice, actually, all cancer is genetic, but what drives those genetic changes in the cells could be partially, you know, you may get a head start because of some of the genetic alterations that you're born with, but the impact of those can be influenced, or you may get, you know, a new nidus of cancer kind of growth occurring as a consequence of lifestyle alongside of that. And in fact, all these factors are overlapping. And then there are also entirely random genetic events that occur that might lead to a cancer diagnosis. And we know from big modeling studies from John Hopkins that cancer overall is about a third of each of these things, all overlapping with each other. So about a third of it is due to genetic factors, a third due to that are hereditary, although maybe not kind of a syndrome necessarily, that may be due to lots of low penetrance genetic risk factors. A third is due to random genetic events that occur in cells, maybe in stem cells in early in development. And they may account for a lot of kind of early age diagnoses that of cancer. And then a third is due to environmental risk. And actually these things are all overlapping. It's a big Venn diagram. So all of genetic risk and all of cancer risk is modifiable through a healthy lifestyle.
Okay. Kevin, one of my fellow colleagues takes regular aspirin just because he has family history. He's not been diagnosed to have any hereditary syndromes, anything like that. Just a quick comment, is he right in taking that? What's the evidence? Or should we be advising patients to take regular aspirin or other COX inhibitors and things like that?
So, I mean, aspirin is very interesting, and there is data from trials of people taking aspirin that the risk of cancer is reduced if they're taking aspirin for, you know, other reasons, and they've looked at their, you know, incidental cancer risk, and particularly for colorectal cancer, the risk of people who are taking aspirin compared to those who are not taking aspirin is, you know, reduced by about 15%. But these are, you know, these are not cancer trials. There was a trial in Lynch syndrome called CAP2 that compared 600 milligrams of aspirin versus placebo. And in that study, in the long-term follow-up, the risk of cancer may be, there may be half as many colorectal cancers. And that's, that was, you know, really interesting and important piece of work. So we do recommend it in the context of Lynch syndrome for that reason. But there haven't really been any studies of, you know, people taking aspirin because they have a family history of colorectal cancer. So we don't really know the impact of taking aspirin in the situation, and therefore we don't routinely recommend it. There may be some benefit because there is some kind of observational data that suggests that taking aspirin reduces colorectal cancer risk. But it's definitely, I would say, a gray area, and it's not something that we are, you know, routinely recommending in people with a family history outside the context of Lynch syndrome. And then other drugs like nonsteroidals, you know, I mean, there also is some evidence of perhaps that, they, you know, that people may get fewer adenomas, for example, if they're taking nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories. But also some of the early trials in FAP, there was some suggestion that the risk of cardiac events was increasing in people taking nonsteroidals, so we don't recommend them routinely. But, you know, it would be very helpful if there was some sort of chemoprophylaxis where the benefit was clearly outweighing the risk. And you will always get adverse events in people who are taking medication, and, you know, as you know. But I think aspirin in the context of Lynch syndrome seems to be relatively safe, and adverse events are rather infrequent. And people who are otherwise healthy, is probably relatively safe, because people who are otherwise healthy are less likely to get side effects, as it were. So I wouldn't necessarily be taking aspirin if I had a family history, but can't say for sure, obviously.
Yeah, my colleague's definitely is happy with the risks, and he thinks that he'll have a mortality benefit from it, so he just takes it anyway. Kevin, that was really insightful into this very confusing topic, definitely for me. I would certainly advise the listeners to kind of refer to the guidelines based on the categories, so how often to offer surveillance for such individuals and things. And thanks for making it clear, especially with some of the other nitty-gritty aspects of this. Any last take-home messages for the audience, Kevin?
Well, I think it's important to try and, you know, have some sort of a system for managing these patients. And, you know, what you don't want is just to offer colonoscopy just because someone has been referred to the family history. What you want to do is offer colonoscopy to people who are likely to benefit. So really taking a moment to assess that risk, assess the family history, and also to reassure patients who have a family history which is low risk that actually the risk isn't necessarily all that increased, and they you know, they're probably not likely to benefit from a colonoscopy more than others. There's almost in every country there's a screening program, and for these people, they should be directed towards the screening program. You know, without being backed into a corner, most people generally are happy to choose to do so.
Kevin, thank you so much for your valuable time and effort. Thanks for Muji.
Thank you very much. Okay. Hope that's all right, Pradeep.